Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Tim O'Reilly. He's the founder of O'Reilly Media, a company that spreads the knowledge of innovators through technology books, online services, magazines, research, and tech conferences. Hey, Tim, how are you doing? It's great to have you on the Cool Tools Show.
Thanks. I have loved Cool Tools since it first came out, and it's always an inspiration. Kind of in some ways goes all the way back to the Whole Earth Catalog. It is the modern Whole Earth Catalog.
Right. There's a direct line. Don't worry. So what's on these days? What's a tool that you are really finding pretty essential that you are enjoying?
Well, you know, in some ways, I want to talk a little bit about a historical tool. It's not so central to my life the way it used to be, but and that is Unix regular expressions.
I don't even know what that means, so you'll have to explain.
Early on in the development of Unix, they figured out a special language for matching text, and it's it's fairly arcane and quite complex. We published a 500 or 600 page book on the subject. You know, we get really complicated. The original Unix regular expressions were, I believe, in an editor called, they started out in Ed, and then it evolved into being used in VI and Emacs. And actually, I first encountered them probably around 1980 on actually a non-Unix system. And I'm not sure if they were identical. But that was when I first got, oh my God, this enormous power that you could start to write scripts that would allow you to do magic with text. Because basically, you could write an expression that says, well, look for this instance of one of these characters, and after you find the first one, do this thing. But anyways, the basis for a bunch of very, very powerful editing tools in Unix. And in fact, it kind of progresses. You had an editor that you used manually, which in my case was VI. But then you also had a command line editor, which you could just sort of write a script to do a series of edits globally throughout the entire manuscript, which was the underlying editor, which was at that point was X. And then there was another editor called SED or Stream Editor. And then that got also superseded in some ways by a sort of a funny hybrid text processing programming language called awk, named after its creators, Aho Weinberger and Kernahan. And then out of that lineage, was descended Perl and eventually Python and all those other sort of scripting languages in Unix. And actually, then there was a sort of another parent, which was the Unix shell. And that, the original design of Unix with all these small programs that work together and then these, they output ASCII text as their, and accepted ASCII text as their dominant input was this design model that was incredibly powerful. And I still remember, the magic that I was able to do with it. I remember once I indexed in one, all-nighter, I indexed something like a 4,000 page documentation set for Burroughs. And it was just because I could search for things, using these regular expressions. And then when I found them, I could input these, manual index entries that would then, spit out. And then I could look at the resulting index. And then I could go back and tweak my script until eventually I had a script that produced the entire correct index. And it was just this sort of magical power over text, because I wasn't originally a programmer. This was my introduction to the power of programming was through text processing. And in fact, Dale Doherty and I wrote a book called Unix Text Processing, which was all about that. And then, of course, the Unix shell, which is where it comes up to the present, because the Unix shell was a command line that was also a programming language. And this was an incredibly powerful concept because you got used to telling the computer to do something. And then you realize, wait, this extra magic syntax I can use where I can make the job easier. If I want to do something 100 times, there's a way to tell the program to do that. And people who grew up in the graphical user interface era just don't get how powerful that is.
So today, you begin by saying this was historical and you're bringing it up. So today, is there a tool or is that tool now incorporated into the modern scripting languages?
Yes. We're in some ways where you're seeing this spirit reborn is in this current mania for conversational interfaces. You know, so a tool like the Amazon Echo with Alexa. Because, and this is actually an insight I had several years ago, and I wish I'd actually pushed harder on it at the time. I was talking with a programmer, one of the first Code for America fellows. This would have been 2012 or so. And he was talking about wanting to work on a visual, you know, sort of programming environment. I said, why would you want to do visual? You know, the next great, interface is going to be, speech. And it's effectively a command line. And when you think about it, when you say, Alexa, play Hamilton, that's a command, right? And it's very analogous to the Unix shell. Where you'd have a command where you'd say, display this file. And here's the thing that's sort of interesting is, Alexa actually has the same mental model in some ways as the Unix shell. So you can say, as my wife Jen Palka tweeted the other day, kind of jokingly, was Tim, tell Alexa to tell the Nest to turn on the heat. and it's that notion of a pipeline, which again was part of that Unix shell design. But anyway, back to regular expressions and the notion of little programming languages embedded in things. I think that there's a really, as a mental model, it's a super important way to think about these conversational interfaces. Because right now, when most people interact with, say, Google Now or Siri or Alexa, they think of being able to issue a single command. But, realistically, there are programming constructs that are implied by some of the things that you can say. So for example, for Google Now, one of my favorite examples was, okay, Google Now, remind me to buy currants the next time I'm at Whole Foods. And that's an astonishingly complex thing conceptually when you think about it. Google has to actually somehow register the fact that, I'm going somewhere at some indeterminate time in the future and to wake up when that event happens and then send me a text reminder. And yet it works.
Does it work on Alexa too?
There's actually a lot of programming logic behind that, So, if you think about the kinds of loops that you have in a program, or conditionals, you have if then, you have until, kinds of conditions, you have, as while or as long as, or, and these actually correspond to natural language concepts. And, the thing that I think is a missed opportunity for a lot of these, current generations of sort of AI agents is they haven't actually formalized the little language behind their agent UI. And I think it's a huge opportunity to kind of go, okay, how do we make this extensible? What are the fundamental constructs? How do we actually tell people? Not everybody will program it, but if they do, they will actually build something much richer. And of course, if this then that is probably the closest thing to that in the modern world. But I will bet you that Alexa does this before any of before Google or Amazon, because I think and I guess that brings me to the kind of a current cool tool. I mean, I love the Echo, I love Alexa. It's a joy to use.
What are some of your favorite uses for it, Tim?
Well, some of it is they're not new uses. It's like play music, but to be able to talk to it, you know, and I find, you know, or things that I would like, you know, what's the weather going to be today? I used to kind of pick up my phone and do a search, and now I just talk to my kids, you know, and that's magical. And, you know, I haven't done, you know, there's certainly lots of new skills, you know, being added. You know, you can call an Uber, and I've been banging on Logan Green over at Lyft saying, you know, when are we going to have the Lyft skill added? Because I think it really is a land grab to get space on that new platform.
So do you say please and thank you as some other people do?
I usually don't, but it's fun. I've tried it. You know, of course, if you say thank you, Alexa, Alexa says, that's what I'm here for. I have to say, it's a great illustration of how, you know, it's not the company with the best technology that necessarily wins. Sometimes it's just the human design touches, and whoever did the work on Alexa did it brilliantly.
Well, there was 1,000 people working on it.
Well, there are now, yeah. I know Jeff's very personally very deeply involved, and you know, he really is a genius.
Yeah, my parents are huge Alexa users.
Yeah,
they love it, and whenever I'm over there, yeah, my mother's just constantly having a conversation with it.
What kinds of things does she ask?
She asks a lot about the weather. She asked to listen to like different NPR programs and stuff.
Yeah, she's that's
like,
actually a great one too. Just the cleverness of realizing that, you know, because it looks at your music and it looks at Prime Music, but you say something like play All Things Considered or, you know, play This American Life. And it, you know, it comes back and says, oh, it's playing in Minneapolis right now, you know, and then it ends, go, okay, now it's playing in Nashville, you know, and they switch to the new channel. You know, it's really, you know, the human curation of the skills is brilliant. And I think that's a kind of really interesting lesson. But anyway, but the big point is here that we're entering the era of command lines again, except they're spoken. And there's a lot to learn from the early days of the Unix shell and the Unix text editing tools that I think will really apply, and the way they were integrated, that will apply in this new command line bot era.
So, oh, yeah, another thing she uses it for all the time is to have it read her Audible books to her.
Oh, nice. I haven't tried that.
Yeah.
Wow, it can read her Audible.
No, I think it just plays Audible.
Yeah, it just plays Audible.
Oh, okay, yeah. I get it. All right.
I just bought one for an elderly friend who has Parkinson's, and I'm looking forward to taking it over and installing it for her. Anyway, we should move on because we can talk about this topic the whole time.
Yeah.
So what's another cool tool that you are using and recommend?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of herbs that I take because they're kind of magical. And when they don't necessarily work for everybody, but the people who I've introduced them to, you know, who they have worked for have had the same experience I have. And that's really, it's a combination of Gan Mao Ling, which is a Chinese herb. I use Plum Flower brand, which you can get on Amazon, and black elderberry. And, you know, there's various versions. I use the Gaia herbs, black elderberry, you know, the veggie caps. But if you feel like you're coming down with a cold, take a combination. It's a little bit by weight. I take 4 of the Gan Mao Ling tablets, which basically taste like, you know, smell and taste a bit like compressed bat guano, or you imagine it would taste like, but you get used to it. And then 2 of the elderberry capsules every 4 hours. And I have found it incredibly reliable in knocking out colds. You know, when you get that feeling of like, oh, I'm going down. And sometimes, usually, sometimes even when symptoms have started, you can head it off. I literally carry that combination with me. I have a little, travel kit with this stuff. I have a little, you know, pill box that I keep in my briefcase so that if I feel the symptoms coming on, I can catch it right at the beginning. It really is magical. And then sort of related to that, at the same time I learned about those, it was from an acupuncturist, astragalus, which I also use the Gaia Astragalus Supreme, you know, daily as a immune system booster. And, you know, again, some people find this to be quack medicine. And I kind of think back to my dad, who was a neurologist, when talked to him when I was a kid, when acupuncture was first coming out of the Western music scene. And I remember him saying, you know, doesn't make any sense, but if it works, it works. And I find it quite remarkable. And then there's one other herb I will kind of mention, which Stuart Brand turned me on to. Not herb, it's a supplement. And that's something called Juvenon, which was developed by Bruce Ames. And Stuart kind of said, you got to try this. And I did. And I felt like it took 10 years off my life, in a good way. I went back to being 10 years longer, younger. I now actually take a generic of it, which is called Anti-Aging LX. But it's... And I also love that Bruce Ames, who, you know, Nobel Prize winning biologist who developed this, actually says it doesn't work for me. I don't know why, but, you know, the science says it should work. But I like the fact that he acknowledges it doesn't work for everybody.
You said that it took 10 years off.
Yeah, I just had so much more energy and joie de vivre. What can I say? And, it was marked in at the time and I've taken it ever since. So that's one. Okay, so let's move on to another cool tool, and that's something I discovered recently, which are my ultra running shoes. And I'm trying to remember which model I have. I think it's the 350. They're these running shoes that have a really wide toe box, and you wear them large. Like I'm normally a 10.5, and the advice is to get them a half size larger, and it's totally right because I end up getting a 10.5 initially, and even though they're comfortable, they fit, they don't have the same effect. But it's a bit like running barefoot inside the shoe. And I should acknowledge I was given my first two pairs, a 10.5 and 11, by Ultra. I was in Salt Lake, which is I think where the company is based, and I was doing a session with Bryce Roberts, my partner at OETV, who sort of started this event, you know, for the Salt Lake startup scene. And Bryce had mentioned that I had run over from downtown out to his office, which was some distance. And so this guy came up to me after, said, I understand you're a runner. Can I send you some of my shoes? And I said, sure, but just be aware that I will only talk about them, you know, if I like them. I'm not going to, you know, kind of, you know, tout them just because you gave them to me. And he says, oh, sure, you know, no problem. And oh, my God, this is the first product that I've actually since bought like six pairs because it's like I'm going, I do not want these to go out of stock. I don't want them to change them. I want to have... You know, when my next pair wears out, I want another one. You know, they're up in the attic, you know, in storage. And they're just a wonderful experience. I wear them all the time now.
So this is Ultra, A-L-T-R-A?
That's correct.
And you said the main thing is that they have a wide toe area.
Yeah, it's a very wide toe box. You know, like I've had a corn on my foot for 10 years, pretty much gone away. And it's just the feeling of comfort when you're running. You know, I tried the barefoot, various kinds of barefoot shoes, and like them. These are actually higher profile than a lot of them, but they have a little bit of that sort of barefoot running thing. But the experience really is because the toe box is so large, your toes spread inside the shoe. And as I said, it feels like barefoot running, but inside the shoe.
So you have the cushion, basically. You have the cushion on the bottom.
Yeah. So they're more cushioned than most barefoot shoes. And anyway, I find them sort of a remarkable innovation. They're great. I wish they looked as good as I have this pair of Innovate sort of barefoot shoes that are really sharp looking. And I wish that they looked as good as they did, but I'll take the comfort any day.
But Ultra has a whole bunch of different kinds of running shoes, and that none of them some of them have pretty thick soles. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, they actually look thicker than they are. They're not actually that really flat barefoot profile, but they do actually inside the shoe, they actually have more of that profile. And I said, I think it's the 315 Instinct, if you're looking online.
Yeah, 3.5 Instinct.
Yeah, that's the one that I'm wearing and that I really like. I did order some of the other models, and there's one that was a trail running model that I haven't really put to the test, but feels really good. But there was another one that I just didn't, the shape wasn't the same.
Do you suspect that it might work if you're just hiking or walking as well?
Oh, yeah, I wear them around for just walking, too.
Yeah. I'll give them a try.
Yeah, no, they're fantastic. And then I guess the last category, I think of books as tools.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, and sure. They're kind of one of the most wonderful tools. And
they're a bargain, too.
What?
They're a bargain.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, the books that are kind of most tools for me are ones that have become part of my mental tool chest. And they're not the books that you would expect. For example, Lao Tzu, Witter Binner's translation of Lao Tzu, it's done in the 50s, I think.
And why that translation of all the translations?
It's the one that I first became familiar with. It's very colloquial. And my friend George Simon, who I kind of introduced me to so much that was interesting and, kind of shaped my thinking. I talked about this in my Long Now talk about the global brain back in 2012, my history with George, somebody who I met when I was, 14 years old, and he kind of taught me a lot about, I ended up giving workshops at Esalen when I was 18, about his work. But he introduced me to that book, and it just became part of my mental furniture. I know most of it by heart, and quotes come up in as a way of just thinking. Another book that's in that category for me, is a book called The Meaning of Culture by John Cooper Powys. He was a Welsh novelist but also essayist and lecturer from the 1930s. And his argument is, he really, in that book, he kind of talks about culture versus education. And, the notion of the culture is education put to use in your life. He actually talks about the merely educated person who kind of has a cookie cutter set of things that they believe versus the truly cultured person has built this sort of personal collection of things that really matter to them. And it's sort of a really wonderful framing metaphor for how, certain kinds of ideas, shape who you are. And so another one that's in that category for me is the poetry of Wallace Stevens. The continual sort of dialectic between, what he calls the naked alpha and the hierophant omega, the notion of, as he says at the end of Esthétique du Mal, one might have thought of sight, but who can think of what it sees for all the ill it sees? One might have thought of sound, but the dark italics it could not sound. And out of what one sees and hears and feels, who could have thought to make so many selves, so many sensuous worlds, as if the midday air were swarming with the metaphysical changes that occur merely in living as and where we live. This sort of sense of this sort of raw, naked world that we elaborate with our minds. And so there's just lines that come to me, a line from The Ordinary Evening in New Haven where he says, the statues go back to being things about. That contrast between the statue that is, full of meaning or, the statue as imminent presence. Anyway, there's just a bunch of stuff like that. And of course, actually, how could I say other than to talk about my friend George Simon, who kind of introduced me to Science and Sanity, Korzybski's sort of slightly crackpot but wonderful book about perception and, the idea of the map is not the territory. And
what was the name of that book?
Oh, Science and Sanity by Alfred Korzybski, another one from the 30s. General Semantics was what it became. And it kind of became a cultish thing. But the fundamental notion that language is a map and that the map can be wrong. My friend George had really kind of taken that and built it into a kind of spiritual practice where it was about to actually get where you are in the process of perception. Are you actually, being in a receptive mode to things as they are? Are you caught up in your experience of them? Are you caught up in the words and the stories about it? Part of the training I got from my friend George when I was, a teenager was in that kind of distinguishing between real perception and just thinking about perception, about thinking about what you've seen. And you can actually see when there are people who are simply rehearsing the words. They're rehearsing the map. They're not actually looking. And someone like Richard Feynman talked about this. He described going down to Brazil, I think it was, who had a new physics curriculum they wanted him to evaluate. And he said he'd only do it if he could be absolutely blunt. And he went and he did. And he said, you guys are totally screwed up. It's all book learning. And he gave this example of, there'd just been a lecture in this class on the angle of incidence of light and various equations relating to this. And he said, so can you tell me how far out, looking out the window, he said, can you tell me how far out at sea those boats are? And he said, no, nobody had the faintest clue about what he was talking about, even though he said, this is something you could do with the equations they just learned, he said, if people's understanding is so fragile, so here are all these people, they've learned the map without ever actually looking from it back to the territory. And a lot of what I've done in my career is sort of, rewriting the map or noticing things where, something was left out. The stuff I did with open source software and versus free software was like, Jesus, this discussion of Linux is really interesting, but why are you guys not talking about the internet software? And it was because the framing metaphor of the free software map was around licensing and the GPL. And I was just kind of going, well, there's this whole other world of free software that's not playing by those rules, but actually is having an even bigger impact. Let's put it in the same map and then see what it tells us differently. And I've tried to do that, ever since, with, Web 2.0. What distinguishes the companies that survived the dot-com bust? And this is what I'm trying to do now with my next economy summit, where I'm saying, okay, there's all these new technologies. What are they teaching us about the shape of the future? And there's a way of thinking which starts with the recognition that the way that we think is not reality. It's simply a reflection of reality, and it can correspond to a greater or lesser degree. The map can be effective and good, or it can lead us astray. And I learned that originally from George and him kind of introducing me to Alfred Korzybski's Science and Sanity.
Wow, Tim, this has been amazing tools, really varied, and I'm going to buy a bunch of these things. One thing that's interesting is a lot of these books you've recommended are out of print and also really expensive.
You can still get them reasonably cheaply. That's where Alibris is a cool tool.
Alibris, it's like a books. It's a used bookstore online.
Yeah. Alibris. It's also, you can find things on eBay, on Amazon itself. I mean, Amazon owns Alibris now, but sometimes you can do a lot better if you go directly to Alibris.com. I find it's quite possible to find most of these things, and they're not always super expensive.
That sounds great. Tim, thanks so much. This has been fascinating.
Yeah, we love it. Great broad range.
Yeah, I'm kind of regretting we haven't done this sooner, I've kind of always owed you because I've never actually sent in to the cool tool. Done a little bit here, and I'll try to do better in future. I can think of at least another dozen things that we could have talked about.